greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Empty Harvest when we come back. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values. And that's because these two programs are the second and eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto. These programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing. Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24. The income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. The income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. This income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And the income tax requires that we sign contracts with foreign and alien gods in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. And Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. And then we're taught to call that income redistribution. The scripture calls it just what it is: covetousness and theft, in violation of Exodus 20, verse 17. Now, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way in Article 1, Section 10 of our Constitution. And I contend that you and I ought to learn how to practice a better way of life than income tax and Social Security. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, informative, and it's free of charge. Tax and status, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct, 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about Empty Harvest. The Empty Harvest, a book written by Dr. Bernard Jensen and Mark Anderson, a 1 in 100 read, called Empty Harvest. You can get a copy of it probably from Acres USA or Barnes & Noble. There are some serious numbers when we talk about disease. Serious numbers. I mean, big numbers, and they're all bad. When we pause to look at the numbers, it's clear that modern disease is unimpressed with the scientific advancement based upon pharmaceutical approaches. Consider cancer, upon which nothing has been spared in this war on cancer, as President Nixon called it, to research pharmacological, radiological, and surgical treatments. By comparison, almost nothing has been spent on natural nutritional therapy. And all of this despite the United States Surgeon General's July 1988 report, which told us, stated, that perhaps two-thirds of all deaths in America in 1987 were related to diet. Did you hear that, kids? The Surgeon General of the United States, back in the Reagan administration, if you can remember that far back, 1987. The Surgeon General in July of 1988 said that Two-thirds of all deaths in America, 1987, were related to diet. You know, every once in a while, somebody in high places will make a comment like that. Alan Greenspan the other day used the R word. You know, we have the F word, that's a no-no. And now we have the N word, that's a no-no. And now the other day, they said Greenspan used the R word, called recession, I think it was. One of these days it'll be banned and the FCC will say, we're going to fine you for using the R word. Well, here we have the diet word, the D word, diet, two-thirds. And here's the Surgeon General. We don't spend anything looking at nutrition in this country. We spend billions and billions of dollars looking for a patent medicine that we can patent so that we can sell it in the drugstore. But nobody's concerned about vitamin C or vitamin A and its interrelation with cancer, heart attack, or stroke. But also in 1987, there were more than 900,000 new cases of cancer diagnosed. Fight disease when you're not causing health. Got that? Fight disease when you're not causing health. Between 1965 and 86, the percentage of adult cigarette smokers dropped by 35%, from 40% to 26.5%, and the cancer death rate still kept climbing. This is more than slightly interesting because smoking is blamed by medicine as the major cause of cancer. So in a period of time when smoking became less popular, cancer continued to grow. Why is that? Furthermore, there's a little section in here that talks about smoking. You know, people have been smoking tobacco. The Native American Indians were smoking tobacco here in North America long before the white man ever showed up on the scene. People were smoking after they showed up on the scene with Columbus in 1492 to about 1900 without the ill effects that we're seeing today from smoking. Now, why is that? Think about that for a second. Could it be that we're spraying our tobacco plants with pesticides, and the pesticide residue on the plants is being inhaled into our lungs? Has anybody ever thought about the chemicals in the tobacco that weren't there 100 years ago, 200 years ago? Just thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration. And by the way, we don't find that we have lung cancer problems among marijuana smokers. I wonder if that's because marijuana plants are grown organically. I just thought I'd throw that out. All right, so let's take a look at United States deaths from cancer. In the year 1937, the number of deaths was 150,000. The number per 100,000 population, 112. In 1960, we had 330,000 deaths. That's 149 per 100,000, a 228% increase. In 1987, we had nearly 500,000 people die from cancer. That's a 200% increase over 1949. And that's a 200 per 100,000. That's a 303% increase over 1960. So, if we take a look at cancer from 37 to 87, 50 years. 50 years of cancer. 50 years of spending billions of dollars to fight cancer. We have a 300% increase, a 200% increase. It moves from 100 people per 100,000 to 200 people per 100,000. You follow that? Now, why is that? What's going on here? Well, we could say this. It may well be, that cancer is incurable, and we'll never find a cure to cancer. And if that be the case, then why spend all these billions of dollars looking for a cure to cancer that we're not going to find? I mean, if you haven't found it in the 50 years from 1937 to 87, what makes you think you're going to find it in the next 50 years from 87 to 27 or 37 again? Now, I'm not opposed to all you people marching and walking and paying your money and your taxes and looking for a cure to cancer. That doesn't affect me. I don't care. I don't want to do that. I'm not going to do that. I already know what the cure to cancer is. More importantly, I know what the cause of cancer is, starvation and toxins. So I'm going to avoid the starvation and avoid the toxins. So far, I've been successful. I think that's a better solution. Now, Americans want to smoke and drink, and they want to eat McDonald's and fat and blood and pig and all the things that cause cancer. And then when they get cancer, they want an instant remedy. They want to be able to go down to the doctor and say, give me this $15 prescription so I can go down here and buy my anti-cancer or my cancer-curing prescription. They don't think in terms of, can we prevent cancer? They think in terms of, how do we cure cancer? Well, okay, if you want to think that way, that's fine. You can do that. And you can cure cancer, but you can't cure it with a patent medicine. And it would be more logical to avoid it. We should pause to ponder some relationships in disease etiology. I wouldn't question the strong case linking lung cancer to smoking, yet related factors exist. Before 1930, before the age of toxic anti-chemicals, depleted soils, and junk foods, there was an abundance of long-term heavy smokers. And lung cancer was a very rare disease. Why was lung cancer so rare in the 1920s with a higher percentage of adult male smokers than we have today? Well, a theory can be made that tobacco growers had long before depleted and exploited their soils. By artificially fertilizing, they grew deficient tobacco plants that attracted all manner of pests and plant disease. Ever-increasing and under-regulated amounts of the highly toxic insecticides like DDT, chlordane, toxaphene, and lindane, and the dangerous organophosphate compounds were sprayed onto the tobacco fields. The act of smoking vaporizes these residues as they're inhaled into the smoker's lungs. Add to this a new generation of humans exposed to severe air pollution of lead, chlorinated naphthalene and other waste products of combustion, industry poisons, increased radiation, junk food, and general deficiency. And smoking may just be the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. In other words, smoking may just be the longest nail in the coffin lid, but not enough to hold it down alone. The first sharp rise in the incidence of lung cancer occurred in 1947. Enter the post-war twins, the atomic age and the chemical age. Now, the cancer rate has continued to climb despite a 17% reduction in alcohol consumption since the 1970s. In 1970, Americans spent $8 billion on legal drugs. In 1986, they spent $31 billion. But are Americans any healthier after spending four times as much money? The total disease care bill for Americans in 1970 was $75 billion, about $350 per person, and about 7% of the gross national product. But in 1986, that number grew to a staggering $458 billion, from $75 billion to $450 billion. Are about $1,800 per person, and 11% of the gross national product. Estimates for 1988 are $511 billion. I might add that in 2007, the number is $1.6 trillion, and they expect $2 trillion a year by 2010, two more years. Medical research based on the germ theory rose from $2 billion in 1970 to $8 billion in 1986. If we need more medical doctors, Americans sure got them. When John F. Kennedy became president in 1960, we had 275,000 MDs. By 1985, we had nearly 600,000. Heart disease is still the number one killer. Half of all men die of heart disease. While the use of antibiotics increased at a mind-boggling rate, the death rate attributed to septicemia, the presence of bacterial toxins in the blood, has soared. Since 1960, the United States death rate from septicemia jumped from 1 person per 100,000 to 7 persons per 100,000. In 1985, an increased death rate of 555% in 25 years. Hey, let's hear it for the pharmaceutical industry and the AMA. Huh? The deaths from pneumonia between 1980 and 85 rose 12%. I thought we had penicillin and antibiotics to cure pneumonia. Now, if that's true, and if antibiotics are the wonder drugs that they're cracked up to be, how come pneumonia in 5 years jumps 12%? Well, these numbers are from the Statistical Abstracts of the United States, published in 1988, published by the U.S. Department of Commerce, Bureau of the Census. All right, we spend more money, we have more doctors, we have more research, more drugs, more surgery, more disease, and more death than ever before. Do you suppose that if we were to spend more money, create more doctors, that we could have more death and more disease? Well, just to give you an illustration, when the consumption of soda pop doubled over a period of 20 years, the incidence of diabetes doubled at the same time. Do you suppose there's any correlation between soda pop and diabetes? I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say that Coca-Cola causes diabetes. But honest to God, kids, do you think Coca-Cola cures diabetes? I mean, you know, let's be intelligent about it. Don't you think somebody, somewhere, with all the billions of dollars of tax money that we spend on health and health projects and so on, ought to just spend, you know, $1 million or $5 million or something like that? Not billions now. Let's not go overboard. But, you know, just, you know, a couple, $3 million and just kind of look into, because the people who write books like this that you buy in health food stores and the underground press, hell, they don't even spend millions. These people don't have that kind of money. People like this Royal Lee that's being mentioned and Bernard Jensen, hell, these are just lone star medical doctors, or naturopaths in many cases, who use their funds that they make off of their private practices to do this kind of research and write these kind of books. Hell, they're not spending the kind of money that the big pharmaceutical companies spend to develop a new drug, for crying out loud. You know, they talk about spending billions to develop this new drug, Tambacor, and they make billions of dollars back until it kills 50,000 people or so, and then they have to take it off the market. And then the FDA goes out and does what? SWAT team raids some health food store in East Podunk, California? And you're sitting there telling me, thank God for government protecting us from all these quacks. All right, now, more money, more doctors, more research, more drugs, more surgery, more disease, more death. Some people ask, well, what America has gained by spending these thousands of billions of dollars? I ask, well, what have we lost? The use of poisons to make war on disease is somewhat like firing squad forming a circle with the prisoner in the middle. I like that one. That's a good one. A firing squad with the prisoner in the middle. He likens that to American medicine. Now, according to the Yale New Haven Hospital study, 1.5 million Americans are hospitalized every year with medication reactions. Did you get that? I mean, these are legal drugs, kids. We're not talking about cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamines. We're talking about the legal drugs. 1.5 million Americans are hospitalized every year. Let's take 1.5 and divide that by 37. And it gives us 0.4. It's 4%. 4% of the people who go to the hospital have to be treated for drug overdoses or not enough drugs or the wrong drugs or something's wrong with the drugs. 4%. Now, this is buried in the statistics file under iatrogenic deaths. By the way, it was President Clinton back in 1999 that blew the whistle. He opened the door. He said 100,000 Americans a year are dying of iatrogenic disease caused by bad drugs. Not cocaine now. Not heroin. By bad drugs. That is, the doctor prescribes the wrong drug, too much drug, or not enough drug. Iatrogenic disease. Then, by 2005, it had grown to 130,000 a year. My God, that's a 30% increase in 5 years. And that's what they admit to. The real numbers are much higher than that, double or triple. But that's what these guys admit to. Now, let's think about this pragmatically. 130,000 people died in the year 2005 from the prescription drugs that they got from the pharmaceutical industry. That's more than double the number of people killed in the Vietnam War, for which all of you people went berserk and flew off the walls and bounced off the ceilings because you got real excited about, oh my God, look at all these casualties coming home in body bags. Well, we kill twice that, and we do it every year. The Vietnam War only killed 60,000 people in 10 years. That's 6,000 a year. Hell, we kill 130,000 a year just from the drug industry administered by your local doctor. Which would tell me that doctors and drugs are 10 times more hazardous to our health than the Vietnam War. That's what I would think. As a matter of fact, it's more than 10. It's more like 20 times more hazardous. And then people compare this Iraq escapade over here and say, oh my God, look at the bodies coming home. Hell, you've only killed 3,000 Americans in this whole Iraq war. Shucks, folks, you got less total casualties. That includes all of the maimed bodies and the guys that had their limbs blown off than you had deaths in the Vietnam War. This is a very cheap, inexpensive war. Very cheap, very inexpensive, and we're pumping billions of dollars into the economy and making Halliburton and Bechtel and Kellogg Brown and Root fabulously wealthy. And look at what we're doing for the stockholders in those companies. And you people are bitching about the war in Iraq. And nobody is telling us about all the good that comes out of the Iraq war and for such a bargain basement price. That's what I'm telling you. The number of people killed in Iraq is minuscule compared to what we're killing every year. Think of it. 3,000 people. Been in Iraq now longer than World War II. Killed 3,000. So they take 3,000. And then let's take 130,000. Okay, take 130,000. We kill those every year. In this year, 2007, we're going to kill 130,000 people. Probably more like 260,000, but they admit to 130,000. Let's divide that by 3,000. That's 43 times more people dead from drugs, legal drugs, than we killed in the whole Iraq war. And we do that every year. 2008, we'll kill another 130,000. 2009, we'll kill another 130,000. 2010, we'll kill another 130,000. And you people are upset about 3,000 guys getting killed in Iraq, and we're killing 130,000 a year down at the local doctor's office? You people, you know, I look at that and I say to myself, have you lost your minds? Have we Americans gone mad, unable to correlate numbers to come to rational decisions? Which is worse, 130,000 a year being killed by legal drugs or 3,000 being killed in the war? I don't know, kid. Now, the number doesn't include the almost 1,000 deaths that occur each week from what a Blue Ribbon Medical Panel termed unnecessary operations. Watch this. You go into the local hospital, and they kill 130,000 of you with bad drugs. Then they kill 1,000 a week. That's 50,000 a year. We kill as many Americans every year as we killed in the entirety of the Vietnam War just from unnecessary operations. Not necessary operations. I mean, you know, when you have your ruptured appendix and we're going to cut out your appendix and save your life. I mean, the unnecessary operations, like cutting off the left foot instead of the right foot, you know, getting the wrong one, or cutting out the left lung instead of the right lung, which is the one that had the cancer in it. You know, little mistakes like that. But, you know, doctors are only human, you know, so they cut out the wrong lung. That 1,000 per week does not include those who die from necessary operations, such as the 6,000 to 8,000 who die annually from complications during gallbladder surgery, called a routine operation. So you got a gallbladder operation, routine, everyday garden variety gallbladder operation. It kills twice as many people. Kids, pay attention now. Listen up. You kill twice as many people every year from gallbladder operations than have died in the entirety of the Iraq War. I never heard anybody get excited about gallbladder deaths or drug death or operations or unnecessary operational death in our hospitals caused by our medical doctors. I've never heard anybody complain about that, have you? I didn't hear Katie Couric come out and say, oh my God, look at these numbers. Now, early detection has been a major focus in the war on cancer. And billions have been spent on the bad news sooner approach. We want the bad news as soon as possible. I want you to tell me, you have cancer. It's the C word. See, now how many of these do we get? We got the F word, the N word, the R word, the D word, and the C word. Oh my God, don't tell me I've got cancer. But what good is bad news sooner if you still approach the problem from the effect side of the cause and effect? And that's what we're doing here with cancer. See, we treat the effect, but we don't treat the cause. We treat the effect. That's where the money's at. The October 1988 British Medical Journal reports a large-scale study. More than 40,000 women during a 10-year period by Swedish physicians reported the use of mammograms, a much-promoted breast cancer early warning screening technique, may not cause a reduction in breast cancer deaths. It's estimated that 42,000 American women will die of this disease in 1989. All right? Do you get that? Now, you got all you ladies over here running in every year and getting your mammograms. But it doesn't reduce the death rate from breast cancer. Let me read that to you again, just in case you missed it. The October 1988 British Medical Journal reports, a large-scale study, 40,000 women during a 10-year period by Swedish physicians, reporting that the use of mammograms, a much-promised and promoted breast cancer early warning screening technique, may not cause a reduction in breast cancer deaths. It's estimated that 42,000 American women will die of this disease in 1989. Why then do you ladies go in to have the mammogram? Because it costs $50 or $75. Right, let's just try this out here. If 42,000 died in 1989, could we then safely say that 42,000 women, because not every woman who had a mammogram died, but 42,000 women had mammograms, would it be safe to say that they all paid about $25 each? I'll bet you it's more like $150 or $300, but I don't know what a mammogram costs. Last time I had a mammogram, I wasn't keeping track of it. So let me try 42,000 in my famous Texas Instruments Sharp EL1197G3 calculator here, and let's multiply that times 25 and see what we come up with. Oh my God. That's $1 billion. Now, how many American women are there? See, there's 150 million Americans, I think it would be safe to say that 150 out of 300, 150 million of them are females. Would that be safe? Now, what these guys are promoting here, they want 150 million of us. I don't think my sharp 1197 is going to handle us, but let's try it. Let's just try 150 million. I'm going to put 150 in here and leave all the zeros off. Let's try 150 million, and let's multiply that times 25 bucks. Now, assuming you could get one, that's $37.50. Now, let's put in all the zeros. 0000000. And let's go here with 36789. Oh, my God. That's $3,750,000,000. That's what they would like to make off of mammograms. It doesn't reduce the cancer death from breast cancer, girls, but it produces an extra $3.75 billion a year in revenue. Well, isn't that just real special? Now, you know, you add up these little procedures, you know, mammograms here and a prostate there and a colonoscopy over here. And, you know, they're always telling you, you know, once you get to be 50, you should come in and have your colonoscopy, whatever that is. And, you know, that's a proctologist looking up your butt. And you should have your breasts examined, and then you should do this and do that and another thing. You know, by the time you paid 25 bucks here, 25 bucks there, 25 bucks again, you know, pretty soon you're adding this up to quite a bit of money. And they're wanting everybody in the country to do this. Kind of like getting your flu vaccine. Thank God that everybody doesn't get a flu shot every year, because if they did, we'd all die for want of flu vaccine, because they never produce enough. They're always short. Always short. But isn't that the way you sell things, is to have a shortage? I mean, if you want a high price for something, you got to have it in short supply. The reason that cocaine and heroin and marijuana sell for a premium price, you know, more than a pack of Marlboros, is because it's in short supply. So the less of it you have, the more money you get for what's left, don't you? It's the way antiques are sold. It's the way they sell. That's the way they sell drugs also. Now, a drug-oriented farming food system, a drug-oriented medical system, and a society that claims to be fighting a war on drugs called our national blight by arresting teenagers and telling them to say no. Just say no to drugs. That amounts to telling our children to believe in a contradiction to every example being set before them in the farm and in the city. I mean, you know, boys and girls, here we are popping pills and sucking down all this alcohol, and we tell our kids, and don't drink, don't drink, don't smoke, and don't take drugs. And what in the hell do? We drink, we smoke, and we take drugs, recreational drugs. And when we're not sucking down recreational drugs, well, then we're out here taking the real stuff, the real thing from Merck and Pfizer. All right, so much for the numbers, serious numbers. Hey, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. And we're heard daily on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy, procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law. From the scriptural perspective, 8 schools total. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. All right, now the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or a local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. One more time, that's area code 417-273-4967. Hey, now that we're talking about the uselessness of drugs and vaccines, I'll just throw vaccines in there. They're about as useless as tits on a boar. My old granddaddy used to say, guys, as useless as tits on a boar hog. Or as they say down here in the Ozarks, a haug. They're not hogs down here, they're haugs, and we don't have valleys, we have hollers. Now let's take a familiar example called the flu. Everybody's got to have a flu shot. They tell me I'm old, and I need a flu shot every year. And I was reading a little story the other day, and they said something like, if you've had a flu shot, if you've had your flu vaccine 5 times out of the last 10 years, you increase the risk of Alzheimer's by about 5 times. So, even if the flu shot worked and kept me from getting the flu, it gave me Alzheimer's disease. Now, what the hell kind of a trade-off is flu for Alzheimer's? Now, they tell me that flu kills 38,000 people a year. Flu, 38,000 a year. Remember the Surgeon General said in 1988 that 2/3 of those diseases are caused by malnutrition? You know, if you people ate correctly, I guess that means more Oscar Mayer wieners and more Big Macs, and then we could eliminate about 2/3 of the disease. Now, the Surgeon General must be telling us then that 2/3 of disease is caused by nutritional deficiency and the other 1/3 is caused by toxins, because disease comes from nutritional deficiencies and or toxins, poisons or starvation. That's what's causing your disease. And your starvation is coming from bad soil. And that's the gist of the article, the little book here we're reading called Empty Harvest by Bernard Jensen and Mark Anderson. And I'm recommending the book very highly. It cost you $14.50. If it were to cure your flu, what if you could live the rest of your life without getting the flu? Would it be worth $14? What if you could live the rest of your life without getting cancer, AIDS, or Alzheimer's disease? Would that be worth $15? I think it is. So for the $15, I think the book is well worth it. Now listen to this. Here's a familiar example of the flu. The word flu, F-L-U, comes from the Italian word influenza. In the Middle Ages, people believed that when you had a flu, you were under the influence of the stars. Influence of the stars. Flu. Our modern concept isn't any whit superior to that concept from the Middle Ages. The flu usually strikes people when? What time of the year? Well, if you'll notice, most flu epidemics begin when seasons change. Flu gets into full flight when the new season has fully arrived. They call it the flu season. If you want to observe a big flu epidemic, just look for some real back-and-forth type of weather, like Indian summer. Let's say October blows cold and snowy, as it can here in Colorado. You might get a big snowstorm in October. Then in November, you can go out in short-sleeved shirt hiking. And then later in November, you can get blizzards again. Then in December, it might warm up. Colorado does several hesitation dance steps coming into winter. Very mild and then cold and then mild and then cold. That's all you need for the makings of a good flu season. But why is that? Well, for one thing, because of the thyroid gland. Thyroid gland. The thyroid is the endocrine gland of metabolism. It helps your body adapt between hot and cold. When the summer is here and it's hot, your thyroid is running comparatively slow or low. We don't need to internally warm our bodies when it's already externally warm. When it's 80 degrees or 90 degrees outside, your thyroid can have a long summer rest. So when winter comes along and we need to warm up the engine and get metabolism up, the thyroid releases thyroxin and its other gland-stimulating hormones to speed up your metabolism. Many naturalist doctors feel that what occurs at this point, because most people have such unresponsive thyroid glands, is that their bodies do not respond appropriately to such temperature changes. This results in unprocessed metabolic waste building up in your tissues and from undigested food accumulating in your system. As waste empties from the tissues, it becomes a circulating fluid called lymph, spelled L-Y-M-P-H. This waste builds up in your intestines, liver, kidneys, spleen, and lymph glands, and generally in the blood and tissues. When all of this waste-loaded lymph backs up, it may back up into your spleen, tonsils, and lymph nodes and vessels. The bowels get very sluggish. Your body wants to generate heat, but the thyroid is not generating any heat. So we spend $200 on a down jacket and say, I'm healthy, I'm warm, the cold doesn't bother me. So, L.L. Bean sells us a warm down jacket, while the unprocessed metabolic waste continues to build up and build up. And what we get next is called the flu. So what does the flu do? Well, the flu is a turbulent detoxification reaction of your body. Every symptom of a cold or the flu, every symptom that the body is not general, it's specific. Every symptom of a cold or flu is a symptom of detoxification. What are the major symptoms of the flu? High fever, or the burning of waste and bacteria. The pores of your skin open for profuse sweating. Diarrhea, your bowels dump. Chills, which generate internal heat. Vomiting and coughing up the expectoration of respiratory mucus. All the cleansing actions of your body. Now, this is a way that your body can violently and quickly get rid of the unprocessed metabolic waste. The waste is a smorgasbord for bacteria. When we start taking all kinds of antihistamine cold pills and drugs to try to stop our body's correct response because we misunderstand what is happening in our bodies. Advertising strives to convince us that these symptoms are universally bad. In this way, they can then sell us relief over the counter in the form of over-the-counter drugs. So let's say that there is a concentration of strep bacteria in some organ. Your lymphocytes, are in the bloodstream and attack the strep. They go to the infection and stimulate reactions to isolate, cluster, and then destroy this infectious bacteria. they create a free radical molecular instability in the infectious bacteria and then cause them to break down. These dead bacteria are then transported into your lymph and your blood for removal. These are methods that your body uses to get these dead bacteria out of your body. But the bacteria is just living on the unprocessed metabolic waste and diseased, malnourished, non-resistant tissues in the first place. Your immune system cannot do anything about the malnourished tissue. All right, let me pause here for a moment and describe this one to you. There's a theory out here that you're walking down the street. You got your mouth open. You're breathing through your mouth. And you suck in this germ. Got it? Okay. Now you're going to get a disease. This is the germ theory. Now there's a competing theory, another theory, and that is that you're starving to death. And because of the starvation, your body then is losing a number of cells, and your body is unable to get rid of all of these cells as fast as they're dying. And the bacteria then come in to decompose these cells, break them down, so that your lymph system can dispose of this waste toxic debris. If it gets too much too fast, this toxic condition, that is, this surplus of toxic waste that your body is unable to get rid of, needs to speed up. And the cold or the flu is the modality that God has designed into your body. Fever to burn up these toxins. Bacteria to break them down and carry them out. In that scenario, then the bacteria are not bad guys. They're just the carnivorous animals eating the waste, that is, the dead animals or the dead bodies in the landscape. Reminds me of a story came out of Idaho some years back. This old rancher, he's driving down the road, you know, in his pickup. And he looks over, and he looks over at the water hole over there, and he sees this dead cow. So he's really concerned. He jumps out of his pickup. He goes over, and he looks at this dead cow. And as he's walking over, you hear a bunch of coyotes, which have been eating on the body, take off and run off. And he gets over there to the dead cow, and sure enough, this cow is about half consumed. And he saw the coyotes running off, and so he said, well, those coyotes must have killed the cow, and they're over here eating it. Made all the sense in the world to him. So he went to the legislature, and he complained about all these coyotes out here killing his cattle. And so the legislature enacted the Omnibus Coyote Bill of 1970, and they hired a bunch of government hunters, and the hunters went out and killed all the coyotes in Idaho. That's the solution. That's treating the effect. Dead cow, coyotes eating the carcass, cause and effect, treat the effect, kill all the coyotes. So, sure enough, it worked. There was not another reported cow killed by a coyote in Idaho from that date forward because there's no coyotes left in the state to kill any livestock. All right, so some time goes by though, and the old rancher, he's driving down the road and he sees a dead cow over by the water hole. And this time there's a bunch of buzzards on it. He runs over, he takes a look at the old cow, and sure enough she's dead. And sure enough the buzzards have been eating on the cow, and so the farmer looks at that and he says, well, my common sense tells me dead cow, cause and effect. Buzzards eating the cow. Buzzards must have killed the cow. And they're eating it. So he runs to the legislature. He says, hey, listen, we got to have some protection out here. You know, you legislators, you government officials aren't protecting us from the buzzards. And so the legislature enacts the Omnibus Buzzard Busting Bill of 1974. And they hire a bunch of government hunters, and they go out and they kill all the buzzards in the state, and it works like a shot. Worked like a shot. Not another cow has been killed by a buzzard. And that's because there aren't any buzzards in the state. They're all dead. They're all gone. Drove them out. All right, so some time goes by. See? And the old farmer's driving down the road again, and he looks out and he sees a dead cow over there by the water hole. And he's real concerned. He runs over, takes a look at it, and no coyotes, no buzzards, but this carcass is just loaded with flies, big green blowflies. And there's just maggots everywhere. And the maggots are falling out of the eyeballs of the cow, and they're just consuming the carcass. And so the farmer, he says, well, shucks, must be the flies killed my cow. And there they are consuming the carcass. He runs to the legislature and says, we need the omnibus fly eradication bill of 1976. And so the legislature makes it against the law for flies in the state of Idaho. And so they run out and they get fly swatters, hand it out to everybody, and everybody's out here swatting flies until finally they kill every fly in the state of Idaho. No more flies left in Idaho. And it worked. Not a single cow has been killed from that day to this by flies in Idaho. And so, by killing all the coyotes, and killing all the buzzards, and killing all the flies, you can eliminate all of the deaths caused by coyotes, buzzards, and flies. No doubt about it. But it kind of begs the question, and it treats the effect rather than the cause. The old farmer's driving down the road, and he looks out and he sees this dead cow over by the water hole again. He runs over there, and the cow is slowly disintegrating, but he can't see what's causing it to disintegrate. So he looks around. He can't see any coyotes. He doesn't see any buzzards. He doesn't see any flies, but this animal is just evaporating in front of his eyeballs. He takes a sample, takes it over to the laboratory, and my God, there's bacteria. The bacteria have attacked the dead flesh, and they're consuming it. They're degenerating it. It's melting away. Farmer goes to the legislature and says, oh, my God, we've got bacteria in the state. We've got to eliminate and eradicate all bacteria. And so they do. They pass the Omnibus 1978 Antibacteria Bill of the Idaho Legislature, and they run out here and they spray the entire state with penicillin. They kill every bacteria, good, bad, and indifferent. There's no bacteria, there's no buzzards, there's no flies, and there's no coyotes left in the state. All right. Now, with all of the predators gone, the old farmer's driving down the road one day, and he looks out there, and he sees a dead cow. He goes over to the dead cow, he looks at it, and this cow is in perfect condition. Deader than a popcorn fart, but in perfect condition. There's no degeneration at all. There's no tooth marks. There's no coyotes eating it. There isn't any buzzards eating it. There isn't any flies consuming it. There's no bacteria consuming the dead flesh. This animal's been out here for days and days, and it's not being devoured. It's not being consumed. It just lays there. He kicks it. It doesn't move. Dead. He doesn't understand it. So he takes a sample of the water, he takes it into the chemist, and they tested the water and found out that it was alkali. He takes some samples from the cow, and he takes it in. The cow drank the water and died of alkali poisoning. So he moved his herd away from the water hole, and no more cows died. Now that's treating the cause. So always tuck that one away in your heart. Just because you got bacteria doesn't mean that the bacteria caused the disease. They may be just there consuming the toxic waste that was produced by the disease. Just kind of like coyotes, buzzards, flies, and bacteria. So all of your immune system is trying to do then is to get rid of the bacteria that's building up too high. It doesn't mind if there are some bacteria working on the waste. It's a matter of degree. The presence of the germs does not constitute the presence of a disease. Tubercle bacilli associated with tuberculosis, for instance, can be cultured in a large percentage of the population that does not have and never will develop tuberculosis. Now, the Center for Disease Control recently reported that 50% of America's homeless population tested positive for tuberculosis, but only 5% had any active stage of the disease. When your body is too toxic and weak, there is too much pollution in the system. If your thyroid is unable to stimulate enough metabolic function to help cleanse the tissues, then the bacteria levels build up even higher, and the militant lymphocytes, or phagocytes, go into action. But these SWAT teams of the immune system require nutrients, such as vitamins, to be effective. The role of vitamins and minerals in fortifying the body against infection is not generally embraced by the pharmaceutical-based medical industry. But that has not prevented hundreds of prominent research biochemists from reporting their myriad findings over the last 50 years about infection-fighting aspects of various vitamins. All right, now we know that vitamin C, that'll cure scurvy. And we know that vitamin A will cure rickets and so on. Now, these various and sundry vitamins have been associated now for the last 100 years with various diseases. Well, beginning about 1912 when we first discovered vitamin A. And we discovered that when you give vitamin A to people who have bad night vision, that their night vision improves. And so we say, oh, you need to eat more vitamin A to cure your, it's good for your eyes. You know, it prevents your blindness or prevents night blindness. Vitamin C prevents scurvy. Vitamin B prevents or cures enlarged hearts. Boys and girls, that's just the tip of the iceberg. You can follow this through. And when you get through, you'll find that all 450 of these symptoms that you people hang the label disease on, and then the pharmaceutical or the medical industry runs down in patents or copyrights so that they can go out and sell cancer, sell heart attack, sell stroke, sell Parkinson's disease to people like you and I that want to buy the effect rather than the cure. Can make money, make profits, boost the economy, makes the world go around. Now, if that's what you want to do, get after it. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. The majority of Americans want to treat the effect, not the cause. And they want to blame it on bacteria and viruses. Bacteria and viruses were created just like coyotes and buzzards to clean up the debris when there's a dead body. So when you have dead cells, you have bacteria to eat up those dead cells. You have viruses to eat up those dead cells. All right, we're about out of time again. We're going to have to leave it right there. So let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.